In this episode, Mark and I are going to talk about the different phases of our 30-year careers.
Whether you can draw or play a musical instrument or sing or dance or take pictures or paint, doesn't matter. You are creative in some aspect and probably many aspects of your life.
All right. Take three. Hi, I'm Chris Hollow.
And I'm Mark Masri, and this is episode number 12 of Creativity in Motion, a podcast about creativity where we talk with creatives of all kinds to find out why they create and especially how they overcome creative obstacles. On today's episode, we're going to be taking a brief look back at the first 11 episodes of our podcast and then moving on to a discussion about the different creative phases of our careers thus far.
Yeah, I think that'll be interesting. We both have evolved quite a lot over our careers. We've had a long time to evolve.
That's absolute truth.
Yeah. Before we get started, we'd like to tell you about our sponsor, Nosy College of Art. Nosy College opened in 1973 as a fine art school and has transformed into Tennessee's only private art college. They offer bachelor's degree programs in commercial illustration, graphic design, film and video, and photography. Starting in September of 2021, they will begin offering a brand new culinary arts associate's degree. They have a beautiful 55,000 square foot facility that was built with the artistic student in mind. That includes computer labs, production suites, photography and video studios, and a fully stocked equipment cage. Everything students need to get creative. To learn more about Nosy College of Art, you can visit nosy.edu for degree program details, faculty information, and student work.
Chris, can you believe it's been 12 episodes?
It has flown by, for sure.
I can remember back in January of this year, 2021, when we were just thinking about getting started on this, and you already had the idea for the topic for the first show, which was how to get started on a project when you seem to have all the enthusiasm in the world, but you can't kind of get over the hump and get it rolling. And to think then that we would have produced 11 episodes of this podcast, it seems kind of unbelievable.
It's pretty cool being able to call in people that you know or the people who you recently met and to get their kind of take on creativity and how they do it and why they do it. And it's just really cool to get to kind of get in somebody else's head for a minute and get out of my own head for just a minute.
Or even people that you normally have a conversation with that goes along the same lines. Every time you see them, you always talk about the same one or two things. And having a reason to bring them in and say, hey, let's go off topic here and talk about some things that we, just in the course of our regular interaction, we don't really have the luxury or the time to talk about some other things that I know you have some interesting ideas about. That's really fascinating. And for me, it's a little bit selfish because it's like, I really like these people and I like how they think. And I, in almost every case, I want more. We're just bound by time and we just don't have time to do that.
I was actually going to say that it feels selfish because these are all people that I wanted to get to know better or in a different kind of a way. And I wanted to learn what they know. And it's, ultimately, we want the people that listen to the podcast to gain this knowledge. But when it comes down to it, the reason we asked them to be on the show is because we want to know what they think or how they do it.
Yeah. And it's interesting to me because I've learned something from each of them. You know, I mean, we've known Elvis Wilson for a long time. My only sort of relationship with him was that we served on an advisory board for the local community college. And so that was about the only time I ever saw Elvis in person. But sitting down and having a chance to hear his story and just kind of observe firsthand how he thinks. And first of all, just feel great that he would come here and give so much of his time to us. That was great. And I found it very reassuring to hear him talk about some of the mistakes that he's made in his career that makes me realize, well, even if someone like Elvis is making mistakes, someone I thought was, I mean, and he is operating at a high level. It just made me realize that mistakes are part of it, you know, and not to feel bad when things go wrong and you have to redo it.
Right. Like we talked about, I mean, making mistakes is the way of growth. And when we started talking with Bill Stieber, I mean, I've known Bill a long time also, and I know more about his photography than his music. So it was a real treat to get to know more about his musical side and how the two sides talk to each other. And it was a real treat that he played some stuff live for us. I thought that was super cool.
It's amazing to watch him play because he's holding the guitar or the ukulele or a banjo, and he's got a harmonica rack around his neck with a harmonica in his mouth. And he's also finding a way to sing and play and do all this at the same time. And it's one thing to just listen to the music, but when you see him produce it in person, it's like a magic trick or something. And it just really makes you appreciate the years of practice and refinement that have gone into his presentation.
There's a joy about it that comes out of him when you watch him do it. You know, it's like he turns on this whole different persona, and there's a joy that comes out of him that's really fun to watch.
Yeah, he also brought up one of the most interesting topics for me thus far in our podcast series, which is the idea that you can put greater and greater constraints on yourself as a way to unlock more and more creativity in yourself. When he talked about the different camera formats that he evolved through in a way, in an effort to find the place where he's most creative and feels most productive with his work. And to me, that is so counterintuitive, but hearing him explain it, it was like a light bulb going off.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then Ray, I mean, I haven't known Ray a long time, but I shot a music video for her, and just listening to her talk about sort of the business end of what she does and how she does it. You know, I mean, I have a business degree, so a lot of that resonated with me. I got to really, I knew what she was talking about, and it was kind of cool to listen to the way she operated the business end of her career.
Ray's a mogul in the making.
For sure.
And when you see her in person, talk with her in person, she's very unassuming. But when she opens up about her ideas for her business and her brand and her music and everything that she wants to do, you realize, holy cow, like it's the tip of the iceberg with her. It was very inspirational.
She's one of those people that you will hear about her success one day and it'll feel like it's out of the blue or immediate, but she's been working at this a long time and she knows what she's talking about.
Yeah. And I know you and I we'll email a link from Forbes. One of us will email that link to the other and we'll say, remember when she was on our podcast?
That's right.
And like, she's the president of Disney now or whatever.
Right.
You know, it's like, yeah, crazy. So
she's a mogul. She's got her own complete, you know, touring show. And it's going to be good. It's just a matter of when.
It is. And you know, with Katie, I think the thing that I found most heartwarming about her was how much she cares about her students. It's evident when you hear her talk, she just sets aside all of her sort of ego and turns her attention to these students of hers. And you forget all the incredible experience she has in her own life, because she's so focused on what she's doing for these acting students and these performing students. Just thought it was really remarkable. And Vince, I didn't even know Vince. You knew Vince.
Yeah, he's the second guest we've had that I've shot a music video for. And he's the kind of guy that when you sit in a room and talk with him long enough, your face will start to hurt. Just he's just a riot. You know, the guy just doesn't turn off, and he's a lot of fun.
Yeah. He walks in smiling. Yeah. And when you look at him, you just instinctively smile. And then you're thinking, what am I smiling about?
Yeah.
And you realize, oh, it's because Vince is smiling.
Yeah. We went, he took me out fishing on his fishing boat. I guess it was pre-COVID, which, by the way, side note, it sucks how everything is now going to be. And that was pre-COVID or post-COVID or during COVID.
I know.
Sucks. Anyway, but pre-COVID, he took me out fishing after we shot his music video. And that was just, you know, two dudes in the dark trying to catch fish. It was awesome.
Yeah. You know, when we talked to Ben Rittenhouse, it was, you know, some of the listeners might remember that Ben is a special effects makeup artist and prosthetics genius. And Chris and I had just finished a very intensive work experience with Ben that had gone into the night, late into the night. We were filming some scenes for our movie. And when Ben came in and sat down with us, it honestly felt like a combination of a catharsis and a celebration of what we had just achieved, because it turned out so well. And actually, we had shot 2 days with him. And I think back on that, and that's the overwhelming memory I have of our conversation with Ben, is just feeling like, thank you, man, for doing such an amazing job on our film, and let's celebrate this together.
It's always cool to talk to people that have not only a real passion for a subject, but also a really deep IQ on the subject, and to be an expert in what they do, and then to turn around and give that back to your students, you know, it's really fun to watch. And I've enjoyed getting to know him better as we move forward through our filming process.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Brendan Barraza and Haley Malone and Savannah Lingle, the three NOSI students we talked to about their education in a visual art and preparation to be a professional creative. I know there's been a lot of feedback at NOSI. I teach at NOSI. And I know there's been a lot of feedback from that, and a lot of faculty members listened to that episode, and it made me feel really good to have been able to shine a spotlight on three students, not only to show how good they are, but also to sort of highlight what a good job I think the school is doing with students these days who are learning professional visual arts. Then we went on our long road trip, our week-long road trip, and interviewed a few people in North Carolina and South Carolina, and one of them was photographer Steve Witsit, someone I've known for over 30 years, but you've known him, you've met him a few times in the past, but having a chance to sit down and talk with him, you know, officially about his work and how he approaches his work, it was very interesting, and I was reminded about what attracted me to him when I first met him and why we hung out so much in those early days.
He spoke highly of you, for sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure. He's got a bad case of rose-colored glasses there, I think. But yeah, that was really, really special. And it's fun, like you said, it's fun to go back and, in a way, pay tribute to these people who are in our lives by asking them to come in and featuring them and bringing their stories up, you know, to light to the people who are listening to this and who hopefully can learn something about creativity and how these people are steering their careers and approaching their careers.
I really enjoyed listening to his kind of origin story on working with Michael Jackson. And even though I get frustrated with, you know, origin stories where they're just lucky in the right place, the right time, and you can't reproduce that. And he was first to admit this is one of those stories, but he ended up working for Michael Jackson for over a year, and you know, just some of the stuff, his takeaways from that, those experiences will never leave you.
It's a good reminder too that we all have those. We all have been just as lucky as Stephen was to land that gig with Michael Jackson. Of course, he never would have landed that gig if he hadn't been able to do it. They knew he was capable. He was professional. He was creative. He had the right temperament, and it always seems like luck, but somewhere along the way, you have had to prove yourself before that opportunity comes to its fullest, right? Before it's an official opportunity that you can take advantage of. And Steve's no exception to that, because, you know, one thing that he mentioned and really made a point to talk about was how he considers the thing that he's most afraid of or most intimidated by, and then instead of sidestepping that to go around it, he actually embraces it and goes towards it as a way to improve himself and force himself to do things that he might not have done before. So it's a pretty amazing story. And even though I had known Jeff Storer, our guest in episode number 10, since my collegiate days at Duke, I was unaware of the very methodical approach that he and Ed Hunt took when they started Man Bites Dog Theater, and how they decided we're going to do plays of this kind. These are the three categories of plays that we're most interested in each season of productions that we put on is going to contain one of each kind of these plays. And it just seemed, it took an endeavor like starting a professional theater company and broke it down into a series of almost mechanical steps where you thought, well, that's very manageable when you approach it that way.
Yeah, but that was a completely stressful and brave thing to bring to that market. I mean, that just bringing the kind of content they brought to that market was a huge risk.
It was huge, but they were acting from their heart, right? It was, and they weren't ashamed or afraid, you know, for that reason. And I think probably as much as anything, I have to think that people responded to the sincerity and the passion with which they were launching this new professional theater company. And even if they were questioning the actual plays and the content, the fact that these guys were so dedicated, you know, I mean, you have to respect that. I just respect that so much.
Yeah. And our third and last interview on our road trip was Dr. Leo Twiggs. And I got to be honest, that was the one that had me the most nervous going into that one. I was afraid. One of the things that frightens me is saying the wrong thing. That's the things you can't take back. And I was stressing over this interview with Dr. Twiggs because, A, neither of us knew him. It was we just reached out to him, and he was kind enough to let us come and visit with him. And the kind of artwork he does has a really heavy, it's not even an undertone, it has a really heavy tone and is very specific to racial injustice and the things that are happening in the country. And I was terrified to say the wrong thing.
Right. And it's obvious when you see his work, but what was amazing, if you're like we, for a brief period, we were only hearing his voice as the voice behind the emails, right? Very short replies to your emails. And you have no idea the quality of his voice, what he looks like physically, what his space is like. And when you, I mean, he's 85. And when you show up at his door and you've never met him before and he's going to welcome you into his home, and then you meet him and you hear him and you, there's such a calming presence. And the fact that you're in the midst of all of this art that some people might consider very controversial or very provocative, or incendiary, and yet you're having a conversation with a man who's like one of the most gentle people I've ever met, it kind of simultaneously puts you in awe and inspires you to have the conversation.
And I'll confess, I edited that version. Mark and I take turns editing these, depending on who has the most time that week. But I cut that one. And what I cut out, which I probably should have left in, was what felt like long periods of time where you and I just sat dumbfounded.
With him talking.
Yes. There was, I took out long stretches of, he would say something profound and you and I would just sit there.
Yeah, the and, silence.
And I probably should have left some of those in because man, we would just listen to him talk and just couldn't respond until we had to collect ourselves a little bit to come up with something to say.
It's really been one of the surprising things about producing a podcast, and being responsible for every aspect of it, both the engineering and the recording on the front end and deciding what the content is going to be. And then on the post-production end, editing all of that. The thing that surprised me is how, like Chris and I decided early on, we wanted to try and keep each of these episodes to an hour. And I've been amazed, first of all, by how you can take an hour and 50 minutes of recording, which we had almost an hour and 50 minutes of recording with the NOSI students, and bring it into an hour and 6 minutes. And at the same time, how we want to try and create an atmosphere or a conversational atmosphere that where anyone's free to talk about anything, about a lot of back and forth. And there was a lot of that with Ben, for instance. and how that can start to get inside your head when you look down at the clock and you go, okay, we're at 1 hour and 2 minutes now, and I know we still have at least 20 minutes worth of stuff that we wanted to talk about. But it's been fascinating to kind of wear both hats, the producer hat and the artist hat, while you want to deliver the most genuine content that you can that's of most interest to your listeners. But at the same time, you're thinking, man, I'm going to edit this. This is going to be a really hard thing to edit, and I'm not looking forward to it, you know, and you have to make those cuts.
Yeah. I will tell you that if you haven't listened to the Dr. Twiggs episode and you go back and listen to it, make sure you stay all the way to the end of the music.
At the end.
The very end. There's a little bit at the end that always makes me smile, and I hope it does for you as well.
Yeah. You know, and that's another thing. Many of you probably don't realize, or maybe perhaps you think that we do the interview and then we go back in later and do all the commentary and the ad reads and all of those things. But we do the ad read in front of the guest. The guest is here for the whole time, and they've been so generous to sit through all of the administrative part of the podcast while we, you know, give some praise to our sponsors and thank people at the end of the episode. And it's been a wonderful experience so far. And I've encouraged many people who I think would be great podcast hosts to start their own podcast with the particular content that I know that they're experts about or that they're interested in, because I think it's a wonderful medium.
So we've done 11 episodes, and this is 12. Most people we knew, only one we didn't know. Some were on the road. What are you looking forward to? Where do you want to go from here?
Surprisingly to me, I have found myself becoming more self-conscious about the kind of interviewer that I am. So I would like to continue to get better at allowing the guests to tell their story in their own words. And sometimes it's a challenge to not put words in their mouth, or it's actually sometimes a challenge just to say accurately what's on my mind without thinking about what it's going to sound like on a podcast. So I'd like to get out of my head a little bit more and just go with the flow. I think that would be helpful. But I'm looking very much forward to having some more guests on, and people that are perhaps not so closely associated with the creative arts, and people who work in industries that people don't associate with being creative. And we've reached out to people like that, and I'm hoping to hear back from them with a resounding yes that they'll participate. Definitely looking forward to that. I know you're looking forward to more road trips.
Yeah, I think anytime we can get it on the road, I think that's fun. And I'm looking forward more to inviting cold calling people and inviting people that neither of us know. It's a little easier to call up somebody that one of us knows. But I like the idea of, like, the Dr. Twiggs one, that we neither of us know them and we're starting from scratch. It's kind of an adventure for both of us.
Yeah, I think for me, the sort of mystery of not knowing how the conversation is going to go can sometimes add some spark to the conversation, because things can go in a direction that you weren't prepared for. I appreciate preparation and how it can help us stay on track. But sometimes I worry that it takes all the spontaneity out of the conversation. And in some cases, it takes the energy out of the conversation. And it's a really hard thing to balance. What I liked about being on the road was like many road trips, it kind of puts you in a headspace. It takes you away from the hustle and bustle and the problems that are lingering around your home or your office or your workplace. And it gets those out of your sight so that it can open up your mind a little bit and allow you to have some thoughts that you might not have if you're at home, which puts you in a different headspace when you sit down to talk with someone. And I think that is very powerful sort of technique to try and practice.
This would be a good time to kind of ask if anybody that listens to the podcast knows of someone or has an idea for us to interview, wants to recommend somebody, to let us know. And they can just drop us an email at creativity at penumbra-ent.com. We'd be happy to look at anybody, because especially people that, like you said, are outside their sort of normal creativity or creative fields, people that maybe don't think they're creative. I bet we can figure out that they are.
I bet we can figure out that everybody is. Mm-hmm. And really, that's part of the purpose of this podcast, is for people to understand that everybody is creative, that it's not something you're just born with. It's something that can be fostered and developed and used in your life. Whether you can draw or play a musical instrument or sing or dance or take pictures or paint, doesn't matter. You are creative in some aspect and probably many aspects of your life. And that's what we really like to talk about.
Well, like what else, what other kind of people would you like to interview? Like, I think a tattoo artist would be cool. A mathematician would be cool.
I think mathematicians are probably some of the most creative people. Scientists in general are, I think, some of the most creative people out there. I think you have to know an awful lot about science before you can start being creative with it. But engineers, honestly, I can tell you some of the most creative people I know are teachers. Mm-hmm. I think it would be interesting to talk with a teacher about ways that he or she gets across, you know, their goals for the class, whether it's elementary school or grad school. Mm-hmm. I think teachers would be fascinating. We send an email out to a choir director. I think that would be a fascinating conversation.
And yeah. We have a way of recording a podcast remotely. So if the person that you know might be a really interesting candidate to have on the podcast, we can also do a remote podcast. They can be in Alaska. It doesn't matter where they are. So they don't necessarily have to be in Nashville. They can be anywhere.
And we don't have to be in Anchorage. It can, you know.
But we might be.
That's right.
You never know.
That's a fun thing to think about. I bet we could have a conversation with the fishermen, mm-hmm. and find out, you know, that there's so much more to what goes on, and the depths to which they have to rely on creativity to solve problems that aren't associated with any kind of the arts or anything. It's just, yeah, it's creative. It's just creativity.
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere. Yeah. It's everywhere. Well, we were thinking about topics that we could talk about. And I've been recently going back through a lot of my old images. And what I realized is when I land on a photo from, say, 1998 or 2007, especially was a big year for this one. And it's like, I look at that and I go, oh yeah, that was my fill in the blank phase. Right. So I identified sort of four phases where I felt like I could chart my photographic development. And a lot of it has to do with lighting. A lot of it has to do with different kinds of cameras and lenses I was using. As I made my way as a creative professional to sort of keep my work fresh, keep myself interested. And I thought maybe we could talk about some of the creative phases that we've been through, or other kinds of phases that we've been through throughout the course of our careers. And truthfully, for a while, I thought filmmaking was just going to be a phase, but I think that is here to stay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've noticed that a lot of my photography over the years has become more cinematic, and that's not by accident.
So what do you mean by that for people who aren't sure what that means?
I'm talking primarily about lighting. The way I think about lighting has changed into more of a cinematic kind of director of photography kind of way of lighting. And I don't think I light like a still photographer like I used to.
So for instance, if you're watching TV and you see a commercial for Tide laundry detergent, that the look of that commercial might not be cinematic, right? As opposed to a commercial about the most recent Lincoln Continental, right? Mm-hmm. Which is typically, I hesitate to use the word dramatic, but the lighting looks more like a scene from a movie mm-hmm. than from something that was created in a studio where the lighting is coming from every direction and there really aren't very many shadows.
Those are lit by cinematographers and they're lit differently. And that's what I respond to more than I ever used to. And I think I could probably sell all my photography lighting and just light everything with the gear that I use for filmmaking.
Now that's sounds very interesting. And, ironically, I would say on the last three photo jobs I've had, still photography jobs I've had, I've taken my video lights with me and used them to kind of still create the look that I would create with flash photo equipment, but approaching the lighting from a different standpoint, you know, from a different perspective. And it's been, I've been very pleased with the results. But it's funny how you have to, like, you can't just do that until you have the idea to do that. And it's hard to have the idea to do that just out of the blue. Like, having the idea has to be influenced by something. Something causes you to have the idea. And once you have the idea, you can turn your attention to it and figure out how to execute it. Through the course of 11 episodes of this podcast, creativity is on my mind more than ever. And I find myself more attuned to things that can give me those ideas.
I just watched a movie last night. I think it's called How I Live Now with Saoirse Ronan. And I could tell, like, the lighting was amazing. And I could tell that the cinematographer was in love with Saoirse Ronan. Like, every shot of her was just amazing. And she was 19. This was 2013, this film was made. And she looked, I mean, it was ridiculous. Like, if you go and watch the trailer for that film or just punt it up in Google and find some stills, you could tell that the cinematographer that lit that had a relationship with her face that was admirable. Like, it was shocking.
Like, it was a muse.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it so much so that I don't even think you could pre-light with a stand-in, because I don't think you might get part way there, but, you know, it's just, there was a relationship there that was unreal.
That's very interesting. The way I live now.
How I live now. I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
I remember one of the first creative phases that I went through in photography came about as a result of my experience working as a photo assistant for the first photographer I ever worked for, which was a man in Ventura, California named Bill Hendricks. And that's where Steve Whitsitt and I met. And Bill had a very unique way of lighting. He could light anything. And I mean, he could light a Tide commercial or he could light a Lincoln Continental. He understood light. He was adept at doing all kinds of things. But when he shot his personal work, which tended to be more portraiture, it was very, he used light that sculpted the person's face or body or environment. And by watching him, I learned how to do that. And for a long time, that's how I shot portraits. I would do it the way that Bill did it. And when I go back and look at those pictures, I recognize them as my photos, but when I see the light that's in them and the way the lighting is designed and set up and executed, it's all Bill, you know. And it's nice to go back and look at your own work and recognize your influences in that. But after a while, I find it kind of unsatisfying because I feel like I'm just emulating someone and I'm not really developing my own style.
You saw him, not you.
Yeah, I saw him and not me, especially in the really, really early ones. And then later, as I migrated out of that phase, I realized, especially when I go back and look at the pictures, it becomes clear to me that I was going somewhere. And in order to go there, I had to leave that behind and move on to the next thing, which is very natural when you're a creative professional or when you're any other kind of professional. I know doctors who start out as pediatricians and then they, 15 years later, they're dermatologists. You know, your interests change and develop. And I think that's a very natural thing to embrace and not resist necessarily.
I had the same issue with the person that I would say mentored me growing up as a photographer. I had a business degree and all I knew was assisting, and I learned by assisting. So I saw the gear he used, the way he lit. And when I went out on my own, I had no choice because that's all I knew.
And you thought I could do that.
That's why I left. It's like, I can do that. So when I went out and did it, I basically picked up where he left off. And then it took time to modify what I was doing I was content with, I was happy with the images I was producing, but it took me a minute to kind of develop my own style. And then as we're talking about it, that style wavers over time and it changes, and you have a pretty good chart of how your images have changed over time. And one of those periods in your life, I remember very well.
Right. That's the, every portrait needs a texture era.
Yes. Yeah. Because that's something that I don't do.
Right. Because it involves,
layers
in Photoshop and yeah. A post-production technique that you'd sort of, you know, in the post-production world, you're kind of like, okay, that's not for me. I'd rather get it in camera.
Yes.
Right. What's interesting is that technique of adding a texture layer over top of, for me, it was a portrait, but it could have been a landscape or anything else, was originally born in me as not a post-production technique, because we learned how to do it in camera in school. And we would, on a large format camera, we would, of course, there's film in the camera, but along with the film, we would insert another piece of material that would sandwich up next to the film and filter the light before it hit the film.
Like a contact print on film.
But it wasn't, it wasn't an image that was being printed onto the film. It was a texture.
Right.
And so it might've been a type of tissue paper, or it might've been something that had a high degree of translucency, but still imparted a texture onto your exposure. And then learning how to control that became sort of a bit of an art form. And I never mastered it, which was why it appealed to me so much when it came to me in a very controllable fashion as a post-production technique in Photoshop, where you can control every element. And that's why I responded to that. I took it way too far. Well, it didn't seem too far at the time, but when that phase mercifully came to an end, I looked back on it and I thought, oh my God, I thought a texture helped everything, you know, like, oh, this is really, really, you like it now. Wait till I put this, you know, granite texture over this, or wait till I add this kind of bit of magic to it. It's going to blow your mind.
That was your Photoshop disco era.
Yeah, that came was my Photoshop. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I was also experimenting with different color palettes then too, and especially colors that were not normally associated with being flattering on human skin, like green. Green is a tough color. Green is the Rodney Dangerfield of the you know, visible light spectrum. Mm. It's the weakest wavelength, and it can be crowded out from your vision very easily by other colors. And so I started trying to boost some greens and aquas with my color palette in portraits to add some interest and perhaps some mystery to the subjects in my pictures. And a lot of that was just me playing and convincing myself that I liked it. And when I go back and look at some of them, when I go back and look at all of them, I should say, many of them, it's just way over the top. You know, I'm grateful for the distance that I have from that now so that I can see it much more objectively. But as an exercise and and, you know, of moving through a phase and letting that phase naturally die out, I think it's very valuable and important. Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I have a phase quite like that visually. I think mine are maybe a little less abrupt. I'm not sure if abrupt is the right word. Did I just insult you?
Well, just more like variations on an overall thing.
Yeah. I can't look back necessarily and say, oh, that was my red phase or my, I guess there was a time when I was using gels, but you know, hell, that's a long time ago.
I went through, let's see, that's gel the phase. Gels are my friend phase. Which, you know, they definitely are our friends, but I don't want to spend all day with them every day.
Well, at the time, I think for me, I was shooting a lot of technology stuff. So I had like a client that I was doing laser, like laser beams and shit like that. And so it was, you know, it lent itself to kind of crazy bright colors. But I don't know that I ever used that sort of gel kind of technique outside of that tech world.
Right.
It was fairly specific.
Yeah. There are photographers that do amazing things with color. Tim Tatter. Nate Afkander, Nate Afkander's, the work he does with gels is so subtle and you almost have to really stare at it to convince yourself, am I seeing color in that shadow? And you are. Gregory Heisler, and these are also photographers who are very technically sound, you know, so they bring a knowledge of the sort of scientific aspect of their craft to bear on their artistic expression of it.
What's that like?
Exactly.
You know.
Well, I mean, yeah, I'm very technical. I was trained in a very technical way and I gravitated towards it because I could wrap my head around it and it made sense to me. I struggle more on the artistic expression end, you know. I mean, you're technical too. You understand, you know, how lenses work and how light works and you know, all of those things. And you understand, you can break that down to a granular level. And you wouldn't be able to appreciate it, I think, if you weren't.
Well, I'm just technical enough to know, to be able to let it go and forget about it.
Yes, but if you wanted to know more, you could learn it in a heartbeat because you're smart and you pick up on things like that. Right.
I suppose.
Yes. You just have sort of said, okay, I'm happy knowing just this. I don't really need to know more.
Yeah.
Right. And so I've struggled sort of trying to, I would say I would make a portrait using a technique just for the sake of using the technique instead of thinking, is this technique going to reveal something about the portrait subject? And it's taken me a while to feel like I understand that other way of doing things. Ironically, I think it's come through cinema and the study of film and watching both directors and cinematographers whose work I love, how they use elements of cinema to enhance the story that they're telling and the emotion that they're trying to get across in their work. So speaking strictly in terms of creativity, that's where ideas come from. It's like exposing yourself to more things and letting the ideas kind of percolate.
I was actually going to bring up cinematography because I've always heard that if the thing that they're saying, the thing that they're doing, the screen, the script, the lighting, the direction, the camera, if it doesn't move your story forward, get rid of it. Like it has to, everything you do has to move your story forward. So if you include things that don't do that, then you're wasting time. You're polluting, you're diluting your message. So, you know, you should stay with only things that ask yourself, does this word, does this phrase, does this prop, does this whatever get move your story forward or not?
It takes so much time watching, listening, studying, practicing your craft to understand how, first of all, what that means is moving your story forward and how to answer that. Like how to know if that's too much, if that's extra. We don't need to do this scene here because this scene is only trying to say this. And if we do it here, we're going to confuse things, right? We're going to imply something that we don't mean to imply. But it takes so much like study and deliberate paying attention to things and questioning and trial and error, you know, and it all goes into it.
Well, it all starts with, and we kind of learned this from Dr. Twiggs, it all starts with, what are you trying to say? And if the thing that you're doing isn't helping say or describe the thing that you're trying to say, you should get rid of it. If it's a color, if it's a brush stroke, if it's the frame that's around your work, if it's the people you hire on your job, if they don't all kind of help to tell the story you're trying to tell, and this could be still photography or video, right? Doesn't matter, film.
Or anything, yeah.
Yeah. If it doesn't tell the story you're trying to tell, then it's not helping. Get rid of it.
What I think is so difficult a lot of the times is I don't know if it's saying what I want it to say.
I know, yeah.
Because I'm too close to it.
Yeah.
And so you have to have somebody or several somebodies that you can say, this is what I'm trying to say. Let me show you this thing and you tell me if that's what it's saying to you. And that is so helpful in getting feedback that you value and guiding you along that path to make sure that you're saying what you want to say. But it's very difficult. You know, what did Dr. Twiggs say?
Your voice.
Your voice, exactly. And he said it took him a while to discover that his voice was best as a whisper. Mm-hmm. And perfectly illustrated when you look at his work. And that's something I've reflected on many times since I heard him say it. What's my version of my voice? What is my voice? I don't know, you know. The NOSI students who are here will tell you that I've told each of them that you have a style. Like, I can look at your work and I can tell you your style. And they all look at me and say, that's crazy because I don't think I have a style. And now I would say that to you about my work. I don't think I have a style. And you would probably say, oh, no, you definitely have a style.
I can tell your work.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the point, is that sometimes we can't make that determination ourselves.
Yeah.
Which is hard.
It is hard. I was just thinking there are some things that you shoot because you're trying to tell a story. And there are some things that you create. I say shoot, create interchangeably. There are some things that you create just because it makes you happy and may or may not be saying anything, or it may or may not have a voice, or you may not. Ultimately, you're putting your voice on it because you're the one making it and you have no choice, right?
Yeah.
But sometimes you just make things because it pleases you. And doesn't matter, there's no client, doesn't matter who likes it or not. It makes you happy, so it makes me happy to do it.
We had a similar conversation to this one in our very first episode, talking about this thing and about needing to do that shot. I can tell you a photo I made recently, well, in the last year and a half, that I can't tell you what it's about, but I loved making it and I like looking at it. And it's a picture of a laundromat that I shot at dusk. And it's not something I just rolled up on and discovered and shot. I drove past this laundromat multiple times and I said, this is the time of day I need to be here. This is where the camera needs to be. And I did. I got there early, pulled my truck up, got out, stood up on the back of my truck, waited for the right time of day, and made a picture of this laundromat. I can't even tell you why, but it was in my head. And I'm very pleased with it. You know, what does it mean? I have no idea.
Does it have to mean something? No.
Well, that's a great thing. Or maybe does it have to mean anything yet?
To you, it does. It means something to you. Because you found it and you executed it, but does it mean anything to me? I don't know. I haven't seen it, by the way. You just send it to me.
Okay, I'll send it to you. but a lot of people look at it and go, "What am I looking at here?" I'm like, "Exactly,
yeah,
exactly,
yeah,
right." You're just looking at this picture. That's what you're looking at,
right?
And if you look at it with expectations, perhaps you won't see anything. But if you just look at it and it catches you at the right moment, you might think, oh, that's kind of weird, but interesting, you know?
You can have that experience going through a museum of classic paintings, or you can breeze through an entire room and nothing means anything to you until you hit one that resonates with you. And you might not know why. I went to a craft fair. This is classic. I go to craft fairs pretty often just because I like to people watch, not necessarily because I like the artwork. But I go to a craft fair and I walk around and nothing really resonates with me. I'm enjoying the day. I'm enjoying watching people. And then all of a sudden I see something that does resonate with me. And I've got two paintings hanging on my wall in the house that I just had to have. And I don't know why they are interesting to me. They just said something to me and I had to have it.
Well, that's the thing about art, right? It's a personal relationship between you and the artwork, whether it's a song or a poem or a limerick or a painting. It's a meaningful to you, and that's what moves you to revisit it frequently, right? Or to have a copy of it hanging on your wall. For me, it's very helpful to realize that's kind of the sum total of it. Mm-hmm. It's just for me. It's because I like it.
Yeah.
You know? And you don't have to like it. As a creative person, it's very helpful to keep that in mind and realize when people are constantly telling you no, it doesn't mean that you're not good and that other people won't like your work. It just means that those people don't see it the way you see it. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of room for everybody's artwork and vision.
Yeah. I think I just figured out why I liked those paintings and I had to have them. My dad was a typesetter and he used to doodle on board that he had attached to his desk. When he's on the phone, he would just sit and doodle. And those doodles had a really specific kind of a line art quality to them that I didn't think twice about it when I was younger, but when I got older, I discovered an artist that I really responded to and by the name of Miro. M-I-R-O. And I just really responded to it. And I realized that the reason I responded to it is because it looked like my dad's sketches on the side of his work surface. And when we went to the craft fair, that reminded me of Miro, which reminded me of my dad's. It was all kind of in the same world. And that's what made me have to have it. Is it resonated with me through something my dad used to do as a chicken scratching.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite all-time movie forever is The Sting. Came out in 1972. And my memory of seeing that for the first time in the theater was my dad taking me to the theater to see that. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's part of why it's my favorite movie. I've watched it many, many, many times since then, and it holds up as an amazing movie on its own right. Of course, it won Best Picture in 1973. Everybody knows that. And but it's that memory. Mm-hmm. It's that association with my father.
Yeah.
And sometimes people respond to things that it comes from such a subconscious level that you would be surprised if you think about it when you uncover what that reason is and you discover that it came from such a deeply subconscious level. And I think you shouldn't be surprised because that's where those powerful emotions and things, experiences that are sort of shaping your life, without you being consciously aware of it, that's where they live, you know? And so anytime you can access that, I think it's always fascinating.
Well, that's the argument for experiencing a wide variety of different things, right? I mean, even if you don't necessarily know that you like Miro because you like your dad's drawings or you like the things that you like, you may have seen something or heard something years ago that influenced you, and you might not be able to pinpoint it or why, but it's become part of you as a phrase or a reaction or a video or a film or something that you've seen or heard, artwork that now becomes part of you and is part of your library of reference material moving forward in your life.
I like that idea that that's reason enough to expose yourself to lots of different things, because if all of these memories and emotions and experiences are alive and well in your subconscious, it's going to take an external force, an external experience, something unexpected to pierce that and to permeate to your subconscious and activate those memories and activate that emotion and desire that you had forgotten about, right? And I think that a lot of times when it comes to creativity and creative output, people like to talk about creative output, like Edgar Wright has a ton of creative output in his films, and Picasso, just a phenomenal amount of creative output. I think it's important to, you need to have a lot of input. Like the more input you have, the more output you will have. And the more diverse and varied your input, music, sports, everything, even if you aren't sure you're going to like it, I think it's important to get that input because it will affect your output one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You may not know it or see it, but it's there.
You won't. You have to trust, you know. Every now and then you get a glimpse of it when you go to a crafts fair and you're inexplicably drawn to a couple of paintings and you're moved to purchase them and not just put them in a closet, but actually put them out and look at them all the time. And then it dawns on you one day, holy cow, I think I understand this now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to have an experience like that before you realize, I think there's something going on here on a level that I'm not exactly aware of.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm looking forward to the next 11 episodes.
Yeah, me too. And I'm looking forward to the next time. I really like featuring people. I think that is great and very satisfying. I'm looking forward to the next time we sit down together and talk about the next things that we talk about, because that conversation is going to be influenced by things that we don't even know about yet,
right,
including the next 11 episodes where we have guests on,
right,
in which we're going to learn all kinds of things about creativity.
Yeah. And as we get deeper into our film that we're making, we will probably end up doing one, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning when we get done shooting, and you'll hear in our voices,
the fatigue,
the pain.
That's right.
But you know, that's okay. It's self-inflicted. We love it.
Self-inflicted.
Yeah.
Creativity in Motion is produced by the team at Penumbra Entertainment. If you like this episode, please consider subscribing so you never miss an episode. Also, we would love to hear from you. So if you have any questions for Chris or me, please send them to creativity@penumbra-ent.com. If you'd like to follow us online, we are at Penumbra Films on Facebook and Instagram, and our website is penumbra-ent.com. We hope you'll join us on the next episode of the Creativity in Motion podcast. Until then, remember, if you want creative output, you need creative input.